Side 3, Unfinished Tales of Numenor and Middle-earth, by J.R.R. Tolkien. Continuing with Narn Ihin Hurin, on page 58. "Ever will some new evil be hatched in Angband beyond the guess of elves and men," they said. And in the autumn of that year, to point their words, there came an ill wind from the north under leaden skies. The evil breath, it was called, for it was pestilent, and many sickened and died in the fall of the year in the northern lands that bordered on the Onfauglith, and they were for the most part the children or the rising youth in the houses of men. In that year, Turin, son of Hurin, was yet only 5 years old, and Urwin, his sister, was 3 in the beginning of spring. Her hair was like the yellow lilies in the grass as she ran in the fields, and her laughter was like the sound of the merry stream that came singing out of the hills past the walls of her father's house. Nen Lalaith, it was named, and after it all the people of the household called the child Lalaith, and their hearts were glad while she was among them. But Turin was loved less than she. He was dark-haired as his mother, and promised to be like her in mood also, for he was not merry, and spoke little, though he learned to speak early, and ever seemed older than his years. Turin was slow to forget injustice or mockery, but the fire of his father was also in him, and he could be sudden and fierce. Yet he was quick to pity, and the hurts or sadness of living things might move him to tears. And he was like his father in this also, for Morwen was stern with others as with herself. He loved his mother, for her speech to him was forthright and plain. But his father he saw little, for Hurin was often long away from home with the host of Fingon that guarded Hithlum's eastern borders. And when he returned, his quick speech, full of strange words and jests and half-meanings, bewildered Turin and made him uneasy. At that time all the warmth of his heart was for Lalaith, his sister. But he played with her seldom, and liked better to guard her unseen, and to watch her going upon grass or under tree, as she sang such songs as the children of the Edain made long ago, when the tongue of the elves was still fresh upon their lips. "Fair as an elf child is Lalaith," said Hurin to Morwen, "but briefer, alas, and so fairer, maybe, or dearer." And Turin, hearing these words, pondered them, but could not understand them, for he had seen no elf children. None of the Eldar at that time dwelt in his father's lands, and once only had he seen them, when King Fingon and many of his lords had ridden through Dor Lomond and passed over the bridge of Nen Lalaith, glittering in silver and white. But before the year was out, the truth of his father's words was shown, for the evil breath came to Dor Lomond, and Turin took sick, and lay long in a fever and dark dream. And when he was healed, for such was his fate, and the strength of life that was in him, he asked for Lalaith. But his nurse answered, "Speak no more of Lalaith, son of Hurin, but of your sister, Urwin, you must ask tidings of your mother." And when Morwen came to him, Turin said to her, "I am no longer sick, and I wish to see Urwin. But why must I not say Lalaith any more?" "Because Urwin is dead, and laughter is stilled in this house," she answered. "But you live, son of Morwen, and so does the enemy who has done this to us." She did not seek to comfort him any more than herself, for she met her grief in silence and coldness of heart. But Hurin mourned openly, and he took up his harp and would make a song of lamentation. But he could not, and he broke his harp. And going out, he lifted up his hand towards the north, crying, "Marrer of Middle-earth, would that I might see thee face to face, and mar thee as my lord Fingolfin did!" But Turin wept bitterly at night alone, though to Morwen he never again spoke the name of his sister. To one friend only he turned at that time, and to him he spoke of his sorrow and the emptiness of the house. This friend was named Sador, a houseman in the service of Hurin. He was lame and of small account. He had been a woodman, and by ill luck or the mishandling of his axe, he had hewn his right foot, and the footless leg had shrunken. And Turin called him Labadal, which is Hopafoot, though the name did not displease Sador, for it was given in pity and not in scorn. Sador worked in the outbuildings to make or mend things of little worth that were needed in the house, for he had some skill in the working of wood. And Turin would fetch him what he lacked to spare his leg, and sometimes he would carry off secretly some tool or piece of timber that he found unwatched, if he thought his friend might use it. Then Sador smiled, but bade him return the gifts to their places. "Give with a free hand, but give only your own," he said. He rewarded as he could the kindness of the child, and carved for him the figures of men and beasts. But Turin delighted most in Sador's tales, for he had been a young man in the days of the Bragolach, and loved now to dwell upon the short days of his full manhood before his maiming. "That was a great battle, they say, son of Hurin. I was called from my tasks in the wood in the need of that year, but I was not in the Bragolach, or I might have got my hurt with more honor, for we came too late, save to bear back the bier of the old lord, Hador, who fell in the guard of King Fingolfin. I went for a soldier after that, and I was in Aethel Sirion, the great fort of the Elf Kings, for many years, or so it seems now, and the dull years since have little to mark them. In Aethel Sirion I was when the Black King assailed it, and Galdor, your father's father, was the captain there in the king's stead. He was slain in that assault, and I saw your father take up his lordship and his command, though but new come to manhood. There was a fire in him that made the sword hot in his hand, they said. Behind him we drove the orcs into the sand, and they have not dared to come within sight of the walls since that day. But alas, my love of battle was sated, for I had seen spilled blood and wounds enough, and I got leave to come back to the woods that I yearned for. And there I got my hurt, for a man that flies from his fear may find that he has only taken a short cut to meet it. In this way, Sador would speak to Turin as he grew older, and Turin began to ask many questions that Sador found hard to answer, thinking that others nearer akin should have had the teaching. And one day, Turin said to him, "Was Lalaith indeed like an elf child, as my father said? And what did he mean when he said that she was briefer?"
"Very like," said Sador. "For in their first youth, the children of men and elves seem close akin. But the children of men grow more swiftly, and their youth passes soon. Such is our fate."
Then Turin asked him, "What is fate?"
"As to the fate of men," said Sador, "you must ask those that are wiser than Labadal. But as all can see, we weary soon and die, and by mischance many meet death even sooner. But the elves do not weary, and they do not die, save by great hurt. From wounds and griefs that would slay men, they may be healed, and even when their bodies are marred, they return again, some say. It is not so with us."
"Then Lalaith will not come back," said Turin. "Where has she gone?"
"She will not come back," said Sador. "But where she has gone, no man knows, or I do not."
"Has it always been so? Or do we suffer some curse of the wicked king, perhaps, like the evil breath?"
"I do not know. A darkness lies behind us, and out of it few tales have come. The fathers of our fathers may have had things to tell, but they did not tell them. Even their names are forgotten. The mountains stand between us, and the life that they came from, flying from no man now knows what."
"Were they afraid?" said Turin.
"It may be," said Sador. "It may be that we fled from the fear of the dark, only to find it here before us, and nowhere else to fly to but the sea."
"We are not afraid any longer," said Turin. "Not all of us. My father is not afraid, and I will not be. Or at least, as my mother, I will be afraid, and not show it." It seemed then to Sador that Turin's eyes were not like the eyes of a child, and he thought, "Grief is a home to a hard mind." But aloud he said,
"Son of Hurin and Morwen, how it will be with your heart, Labadal cannot guess, but seldom and a few will you show what is in it."
Then Turin said, "Perhaps it is better not to tell what you wish, if you cannot have it. But I wish, Labadal, that I were one of the Eldar. Then Lalaith might come back, and I should still be here, even if she were long away.
I shall go as a soldier with an Elf King as soon as I am able, as you did, Labadal.
You may learn much of them, said Sador, and he sighed. They are a fair folk, and wonderful, and they have a power over the hearts of men. And yet I think sometimes that it might have been better if we had never met them, but had walked in lowlier ways. For already they are ancient in knowledge, and they are proud and enduring. In their light we are dimmed, or we burn with too quick a flame, and the weight of our doom lies the heavier on us.
But my father loves them, said Turin, and he is not happy without them. He says that we have learned nearly all that we know from them, and have been made a nobler people, and he says that the men that have lately come over the mountains are hardly better than orcs.
That is true, answered Sador. True, at least, of some of us. But the up-climbing is painful, and from high places it is easy to fall low.
At this time, Turin was almost 8 years old, in the month of Gwairon, in the reckoning of the Edain, in the year that cannot be forgotten. Already there were rumors among his elders of a great mustering and gathering of arms, of which Turin heard nothing. And Hurin, knowing her courage and her guarded tongue, often spoke with Morwen of the designs of the elven kings, and of what might befall, if they went well or ill. His heart was high with hope, and he had little fear for the outcome of the battle, for it did not seem to him that any strength in Middle-earth could overthrow the might and splendor of the Eldar.
They have seen the light in the west, he said, and in the end darkness must flee from their faces.
Morwen did not gainsay him, for in Hurin's company the hopeful ever seemed the more likely. But there was knowledge of elven lore in her kindred also, and to herself she said, And yet did they not leave the light, and are they not now shut out from it? It may be that the lords of the West have put them out of their thought, and how then can even the elder children overcome one of the powers? No shadow of such doubt seemed to lie upon Hurin Thalion. Yet one morning in the spring of that year, he awoke as after unquiet sleep, and a cloud lay on his brightness that day. And in the evening he said suddenly,
When I am summoned, Morwen Eledwin, I shall leave in your keeping the heir of the House of Hador. The lives of men are short, and in them there are many ill chances, even in time of peace.
That has ever been so, she answered.
But what lies under your words? Prudence, not doubt, said Hurin. Yet he looked troubled. But one who looks forward must see this, that things will not remain as they were. This will be a great throw, and one side must fall lower than it now stands. If it be the elven kings that fall, then it must go evilly with the Edain, and we dwell nearest to the enemy. But if things do go ill, I will not say to you, do not be afraid. For you fear what should be feared, and that only, and fear does not dismay you. But I say do not wait. I shall return to you as I may, but do not wait. Go south as swiftly as you can, and I shall follow, and I shall find you, though I have to search through all Beleriand.
Beleriand is wide and houseless for exiles, said Morwen. Whither should I flee, with few or with many? Then Hurin thought for a while in silence. There is my mother's kin, in Brethil, he said.
That is some 30 leagues as the eagle flies.
If such an evil time should indeed come, what help would there be in men? Said Morwen. The house of Beor has fallen. If the great house of Hador falls, in what holes shall the little folk of Holoth creep?
They are few and unlearned, but do not doubt their valor, said Hurin.
Where else is hope? You do not speak of Gondolin, said Morwen.
No, for that name has never passed my lips, said Hurin. Yet the word is true that you have heard. I have been there. But I tell you now truly, as I have told no other and will not. I do not know where it stands.
But you guess, and guess near, I think, said Morwen.
It may be so, said Hurin. But unless Turgon himself released me from my oath, I could not tell that guess, even to you, and therefore your search would be vain. But were I to speak, to my shame, you would at best but come at a shut gate. For unless Turgon comes out to war, and of that no word has been heard, and it is not hoped, no one will come in.
Then if your kin are not hopeful, and your friends deny you, said Morwen, I must take counsel for myself. And to me now comes the thought of Dorioth. Last of all defenses will the girdle of Melion be broken, I think, and the house of Beor will not be despised in Dorioth. Am I not now kin of the king? For Baron, son of Barahir, was grandson of Bregor, as was my father also. My heart does not lean to Thingol, said Hurin. No help will come from him to King Fingon, and I know not what shadow falls on my spirit when Dorioth is named. At the name of Brethil, my heart also is darkened, said Morwen. Then suddenly Hurin laughed, and he said, Here we sit, debating things beyond our reach, and shadows that come out of dream. Things will not go so ill, but if they do, then to your courage and counsel all is committed. Do then what your heart bids you, but do it swiftly. And if we gain our ends, then the elven kings are resolved to restore all the fiefs of Beor's house to his heirs, and a high inheritance will come to our son. That night, Turin half woke, and it seemed to him that his father and mother stood beside his bed and looked down on him in the light of the candles that they held, but he could not see their faces. On the morning of Turin's birthday, Hurin gave his son a gift, an elf-wrought knife, and the hilt and the sheath were silver and black, and he said, Heir of the house of Hador, here is a gift for the day, but have a care. It is a bitter blade, and steel serves only those that can wield it. It will cut your hand as willingly as aught else. And setting Turin on a table, he kissed his son and said, You overtop me already, son of Morwen. Soon you will be as high on your own feet. In that day, many may fear your blade. Then Turin ran from the room and went away alone, and in his heart there was a warmth, like the warmth of the sun upon the cold earth that sets growth astir. He repeated to himself his father's words, Heir of the house of Hador. But other words came also to his mind, Give with a free hand, but give of your own. And he went to Sador and cried, Labadol, it is my birthday, the birthday of the heir of the house of Hador, and I have brought you a gift to mark the day. Here's a knife, just such as you need. It will cut anything that you wish, as fine as a hair. Then Sador was troubled, for he knew well that Turin had himself received the knife that day, but men held it a grievous thing to refuse a free given gift from any hand. He spoke then to him gravely, You come of a generous kin, Turin, son of Hurin. I have done nothing to equal your gift, and I cannot hope to do better in the days that are left to me. But what I can do, I will. And when Sador drew the knife from the sheath, he said, This is a gift indeed, a blade of elven steel. Long have I missed the feel of it. Hurin soon marked that Turin did not wear the knife, and he asked him whether his warning had made him fear it. Then Turin answered, No, but I gave the knife to Sador, the woodwright. Do you then scorn your father's gift? Said Morwen, and again Turin answered, No, but I love Sador, and I feel pity for him. Then Hurin said, All three gifts were your own to give, Turin, love, pity, and the knife the least. Yet I doubt if Sador deserves them, said Morwen. He is self-maimed by his own want of skill, and he is slow with his tasks, for he spends much time on trifles unbidden. Give him pity, nonetheless, said Hurin. An honest hand and a true heart may hew amiss, and the harm may be harder to bear than the work of a foe. But you must wait now for another blade, said Morwen. Thus the gift shall be a true gift, and at your own cost. Nonetheless, Turin saw that Sador was treated more kindly thereafter, and was set now to the making of a great chair for the lord to sit on in his hall. There came a bright morning in the month of Lothron, when Turin was roused by sudden trumpets, and running to the doors he saw in the court a great press of men on foot and on horse, and all fully armed, as for war. There also stood Hurin, and he spoke to the men and gave commands. And Turin learned that they were setting out that day for Barad Athel. These were Hurin's guards and household men, but all the men of his land were summoned. Some had gone already with Hoar, his father's brother, and many others would join the lord of Dorloman on the road and go behind his banner to the great muster of the king. Then Morwen bade farewell to Hurin without tears, and she said, I will guard what you leave in my keeping, both what is and what shall be. And Hurin answered her,
Farewell, Lady of Dorloman. We ride now with greater hope than ever we have known before. Let us think that at this midwinter the feast shall be merrier than in all our years yet, with a fearless spring to follow after.
Then he lifted Turin to his shoulder and cried to his men,
Let the heir of the house of Hador see the light of your swords!
And the sun glittered on 50 blades as they leaped forth, and the court rang with the battle cry of the Edain of the north.
Lacho Calad, Drego Morn!
Flame light, flee night. Then at last, Hurin sprang into his saddle, and his golden banner was unfurled, and the trumpets sang again in the morning. And thus, Hurin Tharion rode away to the Nirnaeth Arnoidiad. But Morwen and Turin stood still by the doors, until far away they heard the faint call of a single horn on the wind. Hurin had passed over the shoulder of the hill, beyond which he could see his house no more. The Words of Hurin and Morgoth. Many songs are sung, and many tales are told by the elves of the Nirnaeth Arnoidiad, the Battle of Unnumbered Tears, in which Fingon fell and the flower of the Eldar withered. If all were retold, a man's life would not suffice for the hearing, but now is to be told only of what befell Hurin, son of Galdor, lord of Dorloman, when beside the stream of Rivel he was taken at last alive by the command of Morgoth and carried off to Angband. Note 2. Here in the text of the Narn, there is a passage giving an account of the Nirnaeth Arnoidiad that I have excluded for the same reason as that given in Note 1. See the Silmarillion, pages 190 to 195. End of note. Hurin was brought before Morgoth, for Morgoth knew by his arts and his spies that Hurin had the friendship of the king of Gondolin, and he sought to daunt him with his eyes. But Hurin could not yet be daunted, and he defied Morgoth. Therefore Morgoth had him chained and set in slow torment. But after a while he came to him, and offered him his choice to go free whither he would, or to receive power and rank, as the greatest of Morgoth's captains, if he would but reveal where Turgon had his stronghold, and aught else that he knew of the king's counsels. But Hurin, the steadfast, mocked him, saying,
Blind you are, Morgoth Bauglir, and blind shall ever be, seeing only the dark. You know not what rules the hearts of men, and if you knew, you could not give it. But a fool is he who accepts what Morgoth offers. You will take first the price, and then withhold the promise, and I should get only death if I told you what you ask.
Then Morgoth laughed, and he said,
Death you may yet crave from me as a boon.
Then he took Hurin to the Howth and Nirnaeth, and it was then new built, and the reek of death was upon it. And Morgoth set Hurin upon its top, and bade him look west towards Hithlum, and think of his wife, and his son, and other kin.
For they dwell now in my realm, said Morgoth, and they are at my mercy.
You have none, answered Hurin, but you will not come at Turgon through them, for they do not know his secrets. Then wrath mastered Morgoth, and he said,
Yet I may come at you, and all your accursed house, and you shall be broken on my will, though you all were made of steel.
And he took up a long sword that lay there, and broke it before the eyes of Hurin, and a splinter wounded his face. But Hurin did not blench. Then Morgoth, stretching out his long arm towards Dorloman, cursed Hurin and Morwen and their offspring, saying,
Behold! The shadow of my thought shall lie upon them wherever they go, and my hate shall pursue them to the ends of the world.
But Hurin said,
You speak in vain, for you cannot see them, nor govern them from afar, not while you keep this shape, and desire still to be a king visible upon earth.
Then Morgoth turned upon Hurin, and he said,
Fool, little among men, and they are the least of all that speak. Have you seen the Valar, or measured the power of Manwë and Varda? Do you know the reach of their thought? Or do you think, perhaps, that their thought is upon you, and that they may shield you from afar?
I know not, said Hurin, yet so it might be, if they willed. for the Elder King shall not be dethroned while Arda endures.
You say it, said Morgoth.
I am the Elder King, Melkor, first and mightiest of all the Valar, who was before the world and made it. The shadow of my purpose lies upon Arda, and all that is in it bends slowly and surely to my will. But upon all whom you love, my thought shall weigh as a cloud of doom, and it shall bring them down into darkness and despair. Wherever they go, evil shall arise. Whenever they speak, their words shall bring ill counsel. Whatsoever they do shall turn against them. They shall die without hope, cursing both life and death.
But Hurin answered, Do you forget to whom you speak? Such things you spoke long ago to our fathers, but we escaped from your shadow. And now we have knowledge of you, for we have looked on the faces that have seen the light, and heard the voices that have spoken with Manwë. Before Arda you were, but others also, and you did not make it. Neither are you the most mighty, for you have spent your strength upon yourself, and wasted it in your own emptiness.
No more are you now than an escaped thrall of the Valar, and their chain still awaits you.
You have learned the lessons of your masters by rote, said Morgoth, but such childish lore will not help you. Now they are all fled away.
This last, then, I will say to you, thrall Morgoth, said Hurin, and it comes not from the lore of the Eldar, but is put into my heart in this hour. You are not the lord of men, and shall not be, though all Arda and Menel fall in your dominion. Beyond the circles of the world you shall not pursue those who refuse you.
Beyond the circles of the world I will not pursue them, said Morgoth. For beyond the circles of the world there is nothing, but within them they shall not escape me until they enter into nothing.
You lie, said Hurin.
You shall see, and you shall confess that I do not lie, said Morgoth. And taking Hurin back to Angband, he set him in a chair of stone upon a high place of Thangorodrim, from which he could see afar the land of Hithlum in the west, and the lands of Beleriand in the south. There he was bound by the power of Morgoth. And Morgoth, standing beside him, cursed him again, and set his power upon him, so that he could not move from that place, nor die, until Morgoth should release him.
Sit now there, said Morgoth, and look out upon the lands where evil and despair shall come upon those whom you have delivered to me. For you have dared to mock me, and have questioned the power of Melkor, master of the fates of Arda. Therefore with my eyes you shall see, and with my ears you shall hear, and nothing shall be hidden from you.
The Departure of Turin. To Brethil, three men only found their way back at last through Tau Nufuin, an evil road. And when Glorathel, Hador's daughter, learned of the fall of Haldir, she grieved and died. To Dor Loman, no tidings came. Rion, wife of Hor, fled into the wild, distraught, but she was aided by the gray elves of the hills of Mithrim, and when her child, Tuor, was born, they fostered him. But Rion went to the Helve in Nirnaith and laid herself down there and died. Morwen Eledwin remained in Hithlum, silent in grief. Her son Turin was only in his 9th year, and she was again with child. Her days were evil. The Easterlings came into the land in great numbers, and they dealt cruelly with the people of Hador, and robbed them of all that they possessed, and enslaved them. All the people of Hurin's homelands that could work or serve any purpose they took away, even young girls and boys, and the old they killed or drove out to starve. But they dared not yet lay hands on the Lady of Dor Loman or thrust her from her house, for the word ran among them that she was perilous and a witch who had dealings with the white fiends, for so they named the elves, hating them but fearing them more. Note 3. In another version of the text, it is made explicit that Morwen did indeed have dealings with the Eldar, who had secret dwellings in the mountains not far from her house. But they could tell her no news. None had seen Hurin's fall. He was not with Fingon, they said. He was driven south with Turgon. But if any of his folk escaped, it was in the wake of the host of Gondolin. But who knows? For the orcs have piled all the slain together, and search is vain, even if any dared to go to the Howth and Nirnaeth. End of note. For this reason, they also feared and avoided the mountains in which many of the Eldar had taken refuge, especially in the south of the land. And after plundering and harrying, the Easterlings drew back northwards, for Hurin's house stood in the southeast of Dor Lomond, and the mountains were near. Nen Lalaeth, indeed, came down from a spring, under the shadow of Amon Darthir, over whose shoulder there was a steep pass. By this the hardy could cross arid Wethrin and come down by the wells of Glithui into Beleriand. But this was not known to the Easterlings, nor to Morgoth yet. For all that country, while the house of Fingolfin stood, was secure from him, and none of his servants had ever come there. He trusted that arid Wethrin was a wall insurmountable, both against escape from the north and against assault from the south. And there was indeed no other pass for the unwinged between Serech and far westward, where Dor Lomond marched with Nevrost. Thus it came to pass that after the first inroads, Morwen was let be, though there were men that lurked in the woods about, and it was perilous to stir far abroad. There still remained under Morwen's shelter Sador, the woodwright, and a few old men and women, and Turin, whom she kept close within the garth. But the homestead of Hurin soon fell into decay, and though Morwen labored hard, she was poor, and would have gone hungry but for the help that was sent to her, secretly, by Irin, Hurin's kinswoman. For a certain Brada, one of the Easterlings, had taken her by force to be his wife. Alms were bitter to Morwen, but she took this aid for the sake of Turin and her unborn child, and because, as she said, it came of her own. For it was this Brada who had seized the people, the goods, and the cattle of Hurin's homelands, and carried them off to his own dwellings. He was a bold man, but of small account among his own people before they came to Hithlum. And so, seeking wealth, he was ready to hold lands that others of his sort did not covet. Morwen he had seen once, when he rode to her house on a foray, but a great dread of her had seized him. He thought that he had looked in the fell eyes of a white fiend, and he was filled with a mortal fear lest some evil should overtake him. And he did not ransack her house, nor discover Turin, else the life of the heir of the true lord would have been short. Brada made thralls of the Strawheads, as he named the people of Hador, and set them to build him a wooden hall in the land to the northward of Hurin's house. And within a stockade his slaves were herded like cattle in a byre, but ill-guarded. Among them some could still be found uncowed and ready to help the Lady of Dor Lomond, even at their peril. And from them came secretly tidings of the land to Morwen, though there was little hope in the news they brought. But Brada took Irin as a wife and not a slave, for there were few women amongst his own following and none to compare with the daughters of the Edain. And he hoped to make himself a lordship in that country and have an heir to hold it after him. Of what had happened, and of what might happen in the days to come, Morwen said little to Turin, and he feared to break her silence with questions. When the Easterlings first came into Dor Lomond, he said to his mother, "When will my father come back to cast out these ugly thieves? Why does he not come?" Morwen answered, "I do not know. It may be that he was slain, or that he's held captive, or again it may be that he was driven far away, and cannot yet return through the foes that surround us." "Then I think that he is dead," said Turin, and before his mother he restrained his tears. "For no one could keep him from coming back to help us if he were alive." "I do not think that either of those things are true, my son," said Morwen. As the time lengthened, the heart of Morwen grew darker with fear for her son Turin, heir of Dor Lomond and Ladros. For she could see no hope for him better than to become a slave of the Easterling men before he was much older. Therefore she remembered her words with Hurin, and her thought turned again to Dorioth, and she resolved at last to send Turin away in secret, if she could, and to beg King Thingol to harbor him. And as she sat and pondered how this might be done, she heard clearly in her thought the voice of Hurin saying to her, "Go swiftly, do not wait for me." But the birth of her child was drawing near, and the road would be hard and perilous, The more that went, the less hope of escape. And her heart still cheated her with hope unadmitted. Her inmost thought foreboded that Hurin was not dead, and she listened for his footfall in the sleepless watches of the night, or would wake, thinking that she had heard in the courtyard the neigh of Aroch, his horse. Moreover, though she was willing that her son should be fostered in the halls of another, after the manner of that time, she would not yet humble her pride to be an alms guest, not even of a king. Therefore the voice of Hurin, or the memory of his voice, was denied, and the first strand of the fate of Turin was woven. Autumn of the Year of Lamentation was drawing on before Morwen came to this resolve, and then she was in haste, for the time for journeying was short, but she dreaded that Turin would be taken if she waited over winter. Easterlings were prowling round the garth and spying on the house. Therefore she said suddenly to Turin, "Your father does not come, so you must go, and go soon. It is as he would wish." "Go?" cried Turin. "Whither shall we go? Over the mountains?" "Yes," said Morwen, "over the mountains, away south. South, that way some hope may lie. But I did not say we, my son. You must go, but I must stay." "I cannot go alone," said Turin. "I will not leave you. Why should we not go together?" "I cannot go," said Morwen, "but you will not go alone. I shall send Gethron with you, and Grithnir too, perhaps." "Will you not send Labadal?" said Turin. "No, for Sador is lame," said Morwen, "and it will be a hard road. And since you are my son, and the days are grim, I will not speak softly. You may die on that road. The year is getting late. But if you stay, you will come to a worse end, to be a thrall. If you wish to be a man, when you come to a man's age, you will do as I bid, bravely. But I shall leave you only with Sador and blind Ragnir and the old women," said Turin. "Did not my father say that I am the heir of Hador? The heir should stay in Hador's house to defend it. Now I wish that I still had my knife." "The heir should stay, but he cannot," said Morwen. "But he may return one day. Now take heart. I will follow you if things grow worse, if I can." "But how will you find me, lost in the wild?" said Turin, and suddenly his heart failed him, and he wept openly. "If you wail, other things will find you first," said Morwen. "But I know whither you are going, and if you come there, and if you remain there, there I will find you if I can, for I am sending you to King Thingol in Dorioth. Would you not rather be a king's guest than a thrall?" "I do not know," said Turin. "I do not know what a thrall is." "I am sending you away so that you need not learn it," Morwen answered. Then she set Turin before her and looked into his eyes as if she were trying to read some riddle there. "It is hard, Turin, my son," she said at length. "Not hard for you only. It is heavy on me in evil days to judge what is best to do. But I do as I think right, for why else should I part with the thing most dear that is left to me?" They spoke no more of this together, and Turin was grieved and bewildered. In the morning he went to find Sador, who had been hewing sticks for firing, of which they had little, for they dared not stray out in the woods. And now he leant on his crutch and looked at the great chair of Hurin, which had been thrust unfinished in a corner. "It must go," he said, "for only bare needs can be served in these days." "Do not break it yet," said Turin. "Maybe he will come home, and then it will please him to see what you have done for him while he was away."
"False hopes are more dangerous than fears," said Sador, "and they will not keep us warm this winter." He fingered the carving on the chair and sighed. "I wasted my time," he said, "though the hours seemed pleasant. But all such things are short-lived, and the joy in the making is their only true end, I guess. And now I might as well give you back your gift."
Turin put out his hand and quickly withdrew it. "A man does not take back his gifts," he said.
"But if it is my own, may I not give it as I will?" said Sador.
"Yes," said Turin, "to any man but me. But why should you wish to give it?"
"I have no hope of using it for worthy tasks," Sador said. "There will be no work for Labadal in days to come, but thrall work."
"What is a thrall?" said Turin.
A man who was a man, but is treated as a beast, Sador answered. Fed only to keep alive, kept alive only to toil, toiling only for fear of pain or death. And from these robbers he may get pain or death just for their sport. I hear that they pick some of the fleet-footed and hunt them with hounds. They have learnt quicker from the orcs than we learnt from the fair folk.
Now I understand things better, said Turin.
It is a shame that you should have to understand such things so soon, said Sador.
Then seeing the strange look on Turin's face,
what do you understand now?
Why, my mother is sending me away, said Turin, and tears filled his eyes.
Ah, said Sador, and he muttered to himself, but why so long delayed?
Then turning to Turin, he said,
that does not seem news for tears to me. But you should not speak your mother's counsels aloud to Labadal or to anyone. All walls and fences have ears these days, ears that do not grow on fair heads. But I must speak with someone, said Turin. I have always told things to you. I do not want to leave you, Labadal. I do not want to leave this house, or my mother. But if you do not, said Sador, soon there will be an end of the House of Hador forever, as you must understand now. Labadal does not want you to go, but Sador, servant of Hurin, will be happier when Hurin's son is out of the reach of the Easterlings. Well, well, it cannot be helped. We must say farewell. Now will you not take my knife as a parting gift?
No, said Turin.
I am going to the elves, to the King of Dorioth, my mother says. There I may get other things like it. But I shall not be able to send you any gifts, Labadal. I shall be far away, and all alone.
Then Turin wept, but Sador said to him,
hey now, where is Hurin's son? For I heard him say not long ago, I shall go as a soldier with an elf king as soon as I am able.
Then Turin stayed his tears, and he said, very well. If those were the words of the son of Hurin, he must keep them and go. But whenever I say that I will do this or that, it looks very different when the time comes. Now I am unwilling. I must take care not to say such things again.
It would be best indeed, said Sador. So most men teach, and few men learn. Let the unseen days be. Today is more than enough.
Now Turin was made ready for the journey, and he bade farewell to his mother, and departed in secret with his two companions. But when they bade Turin turn and look back upon the house of his father, then the anguish of parting smote him like a sword, and he cried,
Morwen! Morwen! When shall I see you again?
But Morwen, standing on her threshold, heard the echo of that cry in the wooded hills, and she clutched the post of the door so that her fingers were torn. This was the first of the sorrows of Turin. Early in the year after Turin was gone, Morwen gave birth to her child, and she named her Nienor, which is mourning. But Turin was already far away when she was born. Long and evil was his road, for the power of Morgoth was ranging far abroad. But he had his guides, Gethron and Grithnir, who had been young in the days of Hador. And though they were now aged, they were valiant, and they knew well the lands, for they had journeyed often through Beleriand in former times. Thus by fate and courage, they passed over the shadowy mountains, and coming down into the vale of Sirion, they passed into the forest of Brethil. And at last, weary and haggard, they reached the confines of Dorioth. But there they became bewildered, and were enmeshed in the mazes of the queen, and wandered, lost amid the pathless trees, until all their food was spent. There they came near to death, for winter came cold from the north. But not so light was Turin's doom. Even as they lay in despair, they heard a horn sounded. Beleg, the strongbow, was hunting in that region, for he dwelt ever upon the marches of Dorioth, and he was the greatest woodsman of those days. He heard their cries and came to them, and when he had given them food and drink, he learned their names and whence they came, and he was filled with wonder and pity. And he looked with liking upon Turin, for he had the beauty of his mother and the eyes of his father, and he was sturdy and strong.
What boon would you have of King Fingal? Said Beleg to the boy.
I would be one of his knights to ride against Morgoth and avenge my father, said Turin.
That may well be when the years have increased you, said Beleg. For though you are yet small, you have the makings of a valiant man.
worthy to be a son of Hurin the Steadfast, if that were possible. For the name of Hurin was held in honor in all the lands of the elves. Therefore Beleg gladly became the guide of the wanderers, and he led them to a lodge where he dwelt at that time with other hunters. And there they were housed while a messenger went to Menegroth. And when word came back that Thingol and Melion would receive the son of Hurin and his guardians, Beleg led them by secret ways into the Hidden Kingdom. Thus Turin came to the great bridge over the Ysgalduin and passed the gates of Thingol's halls. And as a child he gazed upon the marvels of Menegroth, which no mortal man before had seen, save Beren only. Then Gethron spoke the message of Morwen before Thingol and Melion, and Thingol received them kindly, and set Turin upon his knee in honor of Hurin, mightiest of men, and of Beren, his kinsman. And those that saw this marveled, for it was a sign that Thingol took Turin as his foster son, and that was not at that time done by kings, nor ever again by elf lord to a man. Then Thingol said to him,
"Here, son of Hurin, shall your home be, and in all your life you shall be held as my son, man though you be. Wisdom shall be given you beyond the measure of mortal men, and the weapons of the elves shall be set in your hands. Perhaps the time may come when you shall regain the lands of your father in Hithlum, but dwell now here in love."
Thus began the sojourn of Turin in Dorioth. With him for a while remained Gethron and Grithnir, his guardians, though they yearned to return again to their lady in Dor Lomond. Then age and sickness came upon Grithnir, and he stayed beside Turin until he died. But Gethron departed, and Thingol sent with him an escort to guide him and guard him, and they brought words from Thingol to Morwen. They came at last to Hurin's house, and when Morwen learned that Turin was received with honor in the halls of Thingol, her grief was lightened. And the elves brought also rich gifts from Melion and a message bidding her return with Thingol's folk to Dorioth. For Melion was wise and foresighted, and she hoped thus to avert the evil that was prepared in the thought of Morgoth. But Morwen would not depart from her house, for her heart was yet unchanged and her pride still high. Moreover, Nienor was a babe in arms. Therefore she dismissed the elves of Dorioth with her thanks, and gave them in gift the last small things of gold that remained to her, concealing her poverty, and she bade them take back to Thingol the helm of Hador. But Turin watched ever for the return of Thingol's messengers, and when they came back alone, he fled into the woods and wept. For he knew of Melion's bidding, and he had hoped that Morwen would come. This was the second sorrow of Turin. When the messengers spoke Morwen's answer, Melion was moved with pity, perceiving her mind, and she saw that the fate which she foreboded could not lightly be set aside. The helm of Hador was given into Thingol's hands. That helm was made of gray steel adorned with gold, and on it were graven runes of victory. A power was in it that guarded any who wore it from wound or death, for the sword that hewed it was broken, and the dart that smote it sprang aside. It was wrought by Telhar, the smith of Nogrod, whose works were renowned. It had a visor, after the manner of those that the dwarves used in their forges for the shielding of their eyes, and the face of one that wore it struck fear into the hearts of all beholders, but was itself guarded from dart and fire. Upon its crest was set in defiance a gilded image of the head of Glaurung, the dragon, for it had been made soon after he first issued from the gates of Morgoth. Often Hador and Galdor after him had borne it in war, and the hearts of the host of Hithlum were uplifted when they saw it towering high amid the battle, and they cried, "Of more worth is the dragon of Dor Lomond than the gold worm of Angband!" But in truth this helm had not been made for men, but for Azaghal, lord of Belagost, he who was slain by Glaurung in the Year of Lamentation. Note 4. With this description of the helm of Hador, compare the great masks hideous to look upon, worn by the dwarves of Belagost in the Nirnaeth Arnoidiad, which stood them in good stead against the dragons. The Silmarillion, page 193. Turin afterwards wore a dwarf mask when he went into battle out of Nargothrond, and his enemies fled before his face. Ibid, page 210. See further the appendix to the Narn, pages 154 and 155 below. End of note. It was given by Azaghal to Maedhros as guerdon for the saving of his life and treasure when Azaghal was waylaid by orcs upon the dwarf road in East Beleriand. Note 5. The orc raid into East Beleriand in which Maedhros saved Azaghal is nowhere else referred to. End of note. Maedhros afterwards sent it as a gift to Fingon, with whom he often exchanged tokens of friendship, remembering how Fingon had driven Glaurung back to Angband. But in all Hithlum, no head and shoulders were found stout enough to bear the dwarf helm with ease, save those of Hador and his son Galdor. Fingon therefore gave it to Hador when he received the lordship of Dor Lomond. By ill fortune, Galdor did not wear it when he defended Aethel Sirion, for the assault was sudden, and he ran barehead to the walls, and an orc arrow pierced his eye. But Hurin did not wear the dragon helm with ease, and in any case he would not use it, for he said, "I would rather look on my foes with my true face." Nonetheless, he accounted the helm among the greatest heirlooms of his house. Now Thingol had in Menegroth deep armories filled with great wealth of weapons, metal wrought like fish's mail and shining like water in the moon, swords and axes, shields and helms, wrought by Telhar himself, or by his master, Gamil Zirak, the old, or by elven rites more skillful still. For some things he had received in gift that came out of Valinor and were wrought by Feanor in his mastery, than whom no craftsman was greater in all the days of the world. Yet Thingol handled the helm of Hador as though his hoard were scanty, and he spoke courteous words, saying, "Proud were the head that bore this helm, which the sires of Hurin bore." Then a thought came to him, and he summoned Turin, and told him that Morwen had sent to her son a mighty thing, the heirloom of his fathers. "Take now the dragon head of the north," he said, "and when the time comes, wear it well." But Turin was yet too young to lift the helm, and he heeded it not because of the sorrow of his heart. Turin in Dorioth. In the years of his childhood, in the kingdom of Dorioth, Turin was watched over by Melion, though he saw her seldom. But there was a maiden named Nelas, who lived in the woods, and at Melion's bidding she would follow Turin if he strayed in the forest, and often she met him there, as it were by chance. From Nelas, Turin learned much concerning the ways and the wild things of Dorioth, and she taught him to speak the Sindarin tongue, after the manner of the ancient realm, older and more courteous, and richer in beautiful words. Note 6. Elsewhere, my father remarked that the speech of Dorioth, whether of the king or others, was even in the days of Turin more antique than that used elsewhere. And also that Mem observed, though the extant writings concerning Mem do not mention this, that one thing of which Turin never rid himself, despite his grievance against Dorioth, was the speech he had acquired during his fostering. End of note. Thus, for a little while his mood was lightened, until he fell again under shadow, and that friendship passed like a morning of spring. For Nelas did not go to Menegroth, and was unwilling ever to walk under roofs of stone. So that as Turin's boyhood passed, and he turned his thoughts to the deeds of men, he saw her less and less often, and at last called for her no more. But she watched over him still, though now she remained hidden. Note 7. A marginal note in one text says here, "Always he sought in all faces of women the face of Lalith." End of note. 9 years Turin dwelt in the halls of Menegroth. His heart and thought turned ever to his own kin, and at times he had tidings of them for his comfort. For Thingol sent messengers to Morwen as often as he might, and she sent back words for her son. Thus Turin heard that his sister Nienor grew in beauty, a flower in the grey north, and that Morwen's plight was eased. And Turin grew in stature, until he became tall among men, and his strength and hardihood were renowned in the realm of Thingol. In those years he learned much lore, hearing eagerly the histories of ancient days, and he became thoughtful and sparing in speech. Often Beleg Strongbow came to Menegroth to seek him, and led him far afield, teaching him woodcraft and archery, and, which he loved best, the handling of swords. But in crafts of making he had less skill, for he was slow to learn his own strength, and often marred what he made with some sudden stroke. In other matters also, it seemed that fortune was unfriendly to him, so that often what he designed went awry, and what he desired he did not gain. Neither did he win friendship easily, for he was not merry, and laughed seldom, and a shadow lay on his youth. Nonetheless, he was held in love and esteem by those who knew him well, and he had honor as the fosterling of the king. Yet there was one that begrudged him this, and ever the more as Turin drew nearer to manhood. Cyros, son of Ithilbor, was his name. He was of the Nandor, being one of those who took refuge in Dorioth, after the fall of their lord Denethor upon Amon Arab in the first battle of Beleriand. These elves dwelt for the most part in Arthorian, between Aros and Kelon, in the east of Dorioth, wandering at times over Kelon into the wild lands beyond. And they were no friends to the Edain since their passage through Osiriond and settlement in Estolad. But Cyros dwelt mostly in Menegroth and won the esteem of the king, and he was proud, dealing haughtily with those whom he deemed of lesser state and worth than himself. He became a friend of Dairon, the minstrel, for he also was skilled in song, and he had no love for men, and least of all for any kinsman of Baron Echamion. Note 8. In one variant text of this section of the narrative, Cyros is said to have been the kinsman of Dairon, and in another, Dairon's brother. The text printed is probably the latest. End of note.
"Is it not strange," said he, "that this land should be opened to yet another of this unhappy race? Did not the other do harm enough in Dorioth?"
Therefore he looked askance on Turin and on all that he did, saying what ill he could of it. But his words were cunning, and his malice veiled. If he met with Turin alone, he spoke haughtily to him, and showed plain his contempt. And Turin grew weary of him, though for long he returned ill words with silence, for Cyros was great among the people of Dorioth, and a counselor of the king. But the silence of Turin displeased Cyros as much as his words. In the year that Turin was 17 years old, his grief was renewed, for all tidings from his home ceased at that time. The power of Morgoth had grown yearly, and all Hithlum was now under his shadow. Doubtless he knew much of the doings of Hurin's kin, and had not molested them for a while, so that his design might be fulfilled. But now, in pursuit of this purpose, he set a close watch upon all the passes of the shadowy mountains, so that none might come out of Hithlum nor enter it, save at great peril. And the orcs swarmed about the sources of Narog and Taglin and the upper waters of Sirion. Thus there came a time when the messengers of Thingol did not return, and he would send no more. He was ever loath to let any stray beyond the guarded borders, and in nothing had he shown greater goodwill to Hurin and his kin than in sending his people on the dangerous roads to Morwen in Dor Lomen. Now Turin grew heavy-hearted, not knowing what new evil was afoot, and fearing that an ill fate had befallen Morwen and Nienor. And for many days he sat silent, brooding on the downfall of the House of Hador and the men of the North. Then he rose up and went to seek Thingol. And he found him, sitting with Melion under Hirilorn, the great beech of Menegroth. Thingol looked on Turin in wonder, seeing suddenly before him in the place of his fosterling a man and a stranger, tall, dark-haired, looking at him with deep eyes in a white face. Then Turin asked Thingol for mail, sword, and shield, and he reclaimed now the dragon helm of Dor Lomen, and the king granted him what he sought, saying, "I will appoint you a place among my knights of the sword, for the sword will ever be your weapon. With them you may make trial of war upon the marches, if that is your desire." But Turin said, "Beyond the marches of Dorioth my heart urges me. I long rather for assault upon the enemy than for defense of the borderlands." "Then you must go alone," said Thingol. "The part of my people in the war with Angband I rule according to my wisdom, Turin, son of Hurin. No force of the arms of Dorioth will I send out at this time, nor in any time that I can yet foresee."
"Yet you are free to go as you will, son of Morwen," said Melion. "The girdle of Melion does not hinder the going of those that passed in with our leave."
"Unless wise counsel will restrain you," said Thingol.
"What is your counsel, lord?" said Turin.
"A man you seem in stature," Thingol answered.
But nonetheless, you have not come to the fullness of your manhood that shall be. When that time comes, then, maybe, you can remember your kin. But there is little hope that one man alone can do more against the Dark Lord than to aid the Elf Lords in their defense, as long as that may last. Then Turin said, Baron, my kinsman, did more.
Baron, and Luthien, said Melion. But you are overbold to speak so to the father of Luthien. Not so high is your destiny, I think, Turin, son of Morwen, though your fate is twined with that of the elven folk, for good or for ill. Beware of yourself, lest it be ill. Then, after a silence, she spoke to him again, saying, Go now, foster son, and heed the counsel of the king. Yet I do not think that you will long abide with us in Dorioth after the coming of manhood. If in days to come you remember the words of Melion, it will be for your good. Fear both the heat and the cold of your heart. Then Turin bowed before them and took his leave. And soon after he put on the dragon helm and took arms and went away to the north marches and was joined to the elven warriors who there waged unceasing war upon the orcs and all servants and creatures of Morgoth. Thus, while yet scarcely out of his boyhood, his strength and courage were proved, and remembering the wrongs of his kin, he was ever forward in deeds of daring, and he received many wounds by spear or arrow or the crooked blades of the orcs. But his doom delivered him from death. And word ran through the woods and was heard far beyond Dorioth that the dragon helm of Dor Loman was seen again. Then many wondered, saying, Can the spirit of Hador or of Galdor the Tall return from death? Or has Hurin of Hithlum escaped indeed from the pits of Angband? One only was mightier in arms among the march wardens of Thingol at that time than Turin, and that was Beleg Cuthalion. And Beleg and Turin were companions in every peril, and walked far and wide in the wild woods together. Thus 3 years passed, and in that time Turin came seldom to Thingol's halls, and he cared no longer for his looks or his attire, but his hair was unkempt, and his mail covered with a gray cloak stained with the weather. But it chanced in the third summer, when Turin was 20 years old, that desiring rest and needing smithwork for the repair of his arms, he came, unlooked for, to Menegroth in the evening, and he went into the hall. Thingol was not there, for he was abroad in the greenwood with Melion, as was his delight at times in the high summer. Turin went to a seat without heed, for he was wayworn and filled with thought. And by ill luck, he set himself at a board among the elders of the realm, and in that very place where Syros was accustomed to sit. Syros, entering late, was angered, believing that Turin had done this in pride and with intent to affront him. And his anger was not lessened to find that Turin was not rebuked by those that sat there, but welcomed among them. For a while, therefore, Syros feigned to be of like mind, and took another seat, facing Turin across the board.
Seldom does the March Warden favor us with his company, he said, and I gladly yield my accustomed seat for the chance of speech with him.
And much else, he said to Turin, questioning him concerning the news from the borders and his deeds in the wild. But though his words seemed fair, the mockery in his voice could not be mistaken. Then Turin became weary, and he looked about him and knew the bitterness of exile. And for all the light and laughter of the elven halls, his thought turned to Beleg and their life in the woods, and thence far away to Morwen in Dor Loman, in the house of his father. And he frowned because of the darkness of his thoughts and made no answer to Syros. At this, believing the frown aimed at himself, Syros restrained his anger no longer, and he took out a golden comb and cast it on the board before Turin, saying,
Doubtless, man of Hithlum, you came in haste to this table, and may be excused your ragged cloak. But you have no need to leave your head untended as a thicket of brambles, and perhaps if your ears were uncovered you would hear better what is said to you.
Turin said nothing, but turned his eyes upon Syros, and there was a glint in their darkness. But Syros did not heed the warning, and returned the gaze with scorn, saying for all to hear,
If the men of Hithlum are so wild and fell, of what sort are the women of that land? Do they run like deer, clad only in their hair?
Then Turin took up a drinking vessel, and cast it in Syros' face, and he fell backward with great hurt.
and Turin drew his sword and would have run at him, but Mablung, the hunter, who sat at his side, restrained him. Then Cyros, rising, spat blood upon the board and spoke from a broken mouth.
How long shall we harbor this woodwose?
Note 9. Woodwose, wild man of the woods. See note 14 to the Dru Edain, page 387 below. End of note.
Who rules here tonight? The king's law is heavy upon those who hurt his lieges in the hall, and for those who draw blades, their outlawry is the least doom. Outside the hall, I could answer you, Woodwose.
But when Turin saw the blood upon the table, his mood became cold, and releasing himself from Mablung's grasp, he left the hall without a word. Then Mablung said to Cyros,
"What ails you tonight? For this evil I hold you to blame, and it may be that the king's law will judge a broken mouth a just return for your taunting."
"If the cub has a grievance, let him bring it to the king's judgment," answered Cyros. "But the drawing of swords here is not to be excused for any such cause. Outside the hall, if the woodwose draws on me, I shall kill him."
"That seems to me less certain," said Mablung. "But if either be slain, it will be an evil deed, more fit for Angband than Dorioth. And more evil will come of it. Indeed, I think that some shadow of the north has reached out to touch us tonight."
"Take heed, Cyros, son of Ithilbor, lest you do the will of Morgoth in your pride. And remember that you are of the Eldar."
"I do not forget it," said Cyros.
But he did not abate his wrath, and through the night his malice grew, nursing his injury. In the morning, when Turin left Menegroth to return to the North Marches, Cyros waylaid him, running out upon him from behind with drawn sword and shield on arm. But Turin, trained in the wild to wariness, saw him from the corner of his eye, and leaping aside he drew swiftly and turned upon his foe.
"Morwen!" he cried. "Now your mocker shall pay for his scorn!"
And he clove Cyros' shield, and then they fought together with swift blades. But Turin had been long in a hard school, and had grown as agile as any elf, but stronger. He soon had the mastery, and wounding Cyros' sword arm, he had him at his mercy. Then he set his foot on the sword that Cyros had let fall.
"Cyros," he said, "there is a long race before you, and clothes will be a hindrance. Hair must suffice."
And suddenly throwing him to the ground, he stripped him, and Cyros felt Turin's great strength and was afraid. But Turin let him up, and then,
"Run!" he cried. "Run! And unless you go as swift as the deer, I shall prick you on from behind."
And Cyros fled into the wood, crying wildly for help. But Turin came after him like a hound, and however he ran or swerved, still the sword was behind him to egg him on. The cries of Cyros brought many others to the chase, and they followed after, but only the swiftest could keep up with the runners. Mablung was in the forefront of these, and he was troubled in mind, for though the taunting had seemed evil to him, malice that wakes in the morning is the mirth of Morgoth ere night. And it was held, moreover, a grievous thing to put any of the elven folk to shame, self-willed, without the matter being brought to judgment. None knew at that time that Turin had been assailed first by Cyros, who would have slain him.
"Hold! Hold, Turin!" he cried. "This is orc work in the woods."
But Turin called back,
"Orc work in the woods for orc words in the hall,"
and sprang again after Cyros. And he, despairing of aid and thinking his death close behind, ran wildly on until he came suddenly to a brink where a stream that fed Escaldwin flowed in a deep cleft through high rocks, and it was wide for a deer leap. There Cyros, in his great fear, attempted the leap, but he failed of his footing on the far side and fell back with a cry and was broken on a great stone in the water. So he ended his life in Dorioth, and long would Mondos hold him. Turin looked down on his body lying in the stream, and he thought, "Unhappy fool! From here I would have let him walk back to Menegroth. Now he has laid a guilt upon me undeserved." And he turned and looked darkly on Mablung and his companions, who now came up and stood near him on the brink. Then, after a silence, Mablung said,
"Alas! But come back now with us, Turin, for the king must judge these deeds."
But Turin said, "If the king were just, He would judge me guiltless. But was not this one of his counselors? Why should a just king choose a heart of malice for his friend? I abjure his law and his judgment.
Your words are unwise, said Mablung, though in his heart he felt pity for Turin.
You shall not turn runagate. I bid you return with me as a friend, and there are other witnesses. When the king learns the truth, you may hope for his pardon. But Turin was weary of the elven halls, and he feared lest he be held captive, and he said to Mablung, I refuse your bidding. I will not seek King Thingol's pardon for nothing, and I will go now where his doom cannot find me. You have but two choices, to let me go free, or to slay me, if that would fit your law, for you are too few to take me alive.
They saw in his eyes that this was true, and they let him pass. And Mablung said,
One death is enough.
I did not will it, but I do not mourn it, said Turin. May Mondos judge him justly, and if ever he return to the lands of the living, may he prove wiser. Farewell.
Fare free, said Mablung, for that is your wish. But well I do not hope for, if you go in this way. A shadow is on your heart. When we meet again, may it be no darker.
To that, Turin made no answer, but left them, and went swiftly away, none knew whither. It is told that when Turin did not return to the north marches of Dorioth, and no tidings could be heard of him, Beleg Strongbow came himself to Menegroth to seek him, and with heavy heart he gathered news of Turin's deeds and flight. Soon afterwards, Thingol and Melion came back to their halls, for the summer was waning. And when the king heard report of what had passed, he sat upon his throne in the great hall of Menegroth, and about him were all the lords and counselors of Dorioth. Then all was searched and told, even to the parting words of Turin, and at the last Thingol sighed, and he said,
Alas, how has this shadow stolen into my realm? Syros I accounted faithful and wise, but if he lived, he would feel my anger, for his taunting was evil, and I hold him to blame for all that chanced in the hall. So far Turin has my pardon, but the shaming of Syros and the hounding of him to his death were wrongs greater than the offense, and these deeds I cannot pass over. They show a hard heart and proud.
Then Thingol fell silent, but at last he spoke again in sadness.
This is an ungrateful foster son, and a man too proud for his state. How shall I harbor one who scorns me and my law, or pardon one who will not repent? Therefore, I will banish Turin, son of Hurin, from the kingdom of Dorioth. If he seeks entry, he shall be brought to judgment before me, and until he sues for pardon at my feet, he is my son no longer. If any here accounts this unjust, let him speak.
Then there was silence in the hall, and Thingol lifted up his hand to pronounce his doom. But at that moment Beleg entered in haste and cried,
Lord, may I yet speak? You come late, said Thingol. Were you not bidden with the others?
Truly, Lord, answered Beleg, but I was delayed. I sought for one whom I knew. Now I bring at last a witness who should be heard ere your doom falls.
All were summoned who had aught to tell, said the king. What can he tell now of more weight than those to whom I have listened?
You shall judge when you have heard, said Beleg. Grant this to me, if I have ever deserved your grace.
To you I grant it, said Thingol.
Then Beleg went out, and led in by the hand the maiden Nelas, who dwelt in the woods, and came never into Menegroth. And she was afraid, both for the great pillared hall and the roof of stone, and for the company of many eyes that watched her. And when Thingol bade her speak, she said, Lord, I was sitting in a tree. But then she faltered in awe of the king, and could say no more. At that the king smiled, and said,
Others have done this also, but have felt no need to tell me of it.
Others indeed, said she, taking courage from his smile. Even Luthien, and of her I was thinking that morning, and of Baron, the man. To that Thingol said nothing, and he smiled no longer, but waited until Nelos should speak again. For Turin reminded me of Baron, she said at last. They are akin, I am told, and their kinship can be seen by some that look close.
Then Thingol grew impatient. That may be, he said,
But Turin, son of Hurin, is gone in scorn of me, and you will see him no more to read his kindred. For now I will speak my judgment.
Lord King, she cried then, bear with me, and let me speak first. I sat in a tree to look on Turin as he went away, and I saw Syros come out from the wood with sword and shield, and spring on Turin at unawares. At that there was a murmur in the hall, and the king lifted his hand, saying,
you bring graver news to my ear than seemed likely. Take heed now to all that you say, for this is a court of doom.
So Beleg has told me, she answered, and only for that have I dared to come here, so that Turin shall not be ill-judged. He is valiant, but he is merciful. They fought, Lord, these two, until Turin had bereft Syros of both shield and sword, but he did not slay him. Therefore I do not believe that he willed his death in the end. If Syros were put to shame, it was shame that he had earned.
Judgment is mine, said Thingol, but what you have told shall govern it.
Then he questioned Nelas closely, and at last he turned to Mablung, saying,
it is strange to me that Turin said nothing of this to you.
Yet he did not, said Mablung, and had he spoken of it, otherwise would my words have been to him at parting.
And otherwise shall my doom now be, said Thingol. Hear me! Such fault as can be found in Turin I now pardon, holding him wronged and provoked. And since it was indeed, as he said, one of my council who so misused him, he shall not seek for this pardon, but I will send it to him, wherever he may be found, and I will recall him in honor to my halls.
But when the doom was pronounced, suddenly Nelas wept. Where can he be found? She said. He has left our land, and the world is wide.
He shall be sought, said Thingol.
Then he rose, and Beleg led Nelas forth from Menegroth, and he said to her, do not weep, for if Turin lives or walks still abroad, I shall find him, though all others fail. On the next day, Beleg came before Thingol and Melion, and the king said to him,
counsel me, Beleg, for I am grieved. I took Hurin's son as my son, and so he shall remain, unless Hurin himself should return out of the shadows to claim his own. I would not have any say that Turin was driven forth unjustly into the wild, and gladly would I welcome him back, for I loved him well.
And Beleg answered,
I will seek Turin until I find him, and I will bring him back to Menegroth if I can, for I love him also.
Then he departed, and far across Beleriand he sought in vain for tidings of Turin through many perils, and that winter passed away, and the spring after. Turin among the outlaws. Now the tale turns again to Turin. He, believing himself an outlaw, whom the king would pursue, did not return to Beleg on the north marches of Dorioth, but went away westward, and passing secretly out of the guarded realm, came into the woodlands south of Taglan. There, before the Nearknife, many men had dwelt in scattered homesteads. They were of Haleth's folk, for the most part, but owned no lord, and they lived both by hunting and by husbandry, keeping swine in the mastlands, and tilling clearings in the forest which were fenced from the wild. But most were now destroyed, or had fled into Brethil, and all that region lay under the fear of orcs and of outlaws. For in that time of ruin, houseless and desperate men went astray, remnants of battle and defeat, and lands laid waste, and some were men driven into the wild for evil deeds. They hunted and gathered such food as they could, but in winter, when hunger drove them, they were to be feared as wolves, and Gawrwaith, the wolfmen, they were called, by those who still defended their homes. Some 50 of these men had joined in one band, wandering in the woods beyond the western marches of Dorioth, and they were hated scarcely less than orcs, for there were among them outcasts hard of heart, bearing a grudge against their own kind. The grimmest among them was one named Ondrog, hunted from Dor Lomond for the slaying of a woman, and others also came from that land, old Algund, the oldest of the fellowship, who had fled from the Nearknife, and Forweg, as he named himself, the captain of the band, a man with fair hair and unsteady glittering eyes, big and bold, but far fallen from the ways of the Edain, of the people of Hador.
They were become very wary, and they set scouts or a watch about them, whether moving or at rest, and thus they were quickly aware of Turin when he strayed into their haunts. They trailed him, and they drew a ring about him, and suddenly, as he came out into a glade beside a stream, he found himself within a circle of men with bent bows and drawn swords. Then Turin halted, but he showed no fear.
"Who are you?" he said. "I thought that only orcs waylaid men, but I see that I am mistaken."
"You may rue the mistake," said Forweg, "for these are our haunts, and we do not allow other men to walk in them. We take their lives as forfeit, unless they can ransom them."
Then Turin laughed.
"You will get no ransom from me," he said, "an outcast and an outlaw. You may search me when I am dead, but it will cost you dearly to prove my words true."
Nonetheless, his death seemed near, for many arrows were notched to the string, waiting for the word of the captain, and none of his enemies stood within reach of a leap with drawn sword. But Turin, seeing some stones at the stream's edge before his feet, stooped suddenly, and in that instant one of the men, angered by his words, let fly a shaft. But it passed over Turin, and he, springing up, cast a stone at the bowman with great force and true aim, and he fell to the ground with broken skull.
"I might be of more service to you alive in the place of that luckless man," said Turin, and turning to Forweg, he said, "If you are the captain here, you should not allow your men to shoot without command."
"I do not," said Forweg, "but he has been rebuked swiftly enough. I will take you in his stead, if you will heed my words better."
Then two of the outlaws cried out against him, and one was a friend of the fallen man. Ulrad was his name.
"A strange way to gain entry to a fellowship," he said, "the slaying of one of the best men."
"Not unchallenged," said Turin. "But come then, I will endure you both together, with weapons or with strength alone, and then you shall see if I am fit to replace one of your best men."
Then he strode towards them, but Ulrad gave back and would not fight. The other threw down his bow and looked Turin up and down, and this man was Androg of Dor Lomen.
"I am not your match," he said at length, shaking his head.
"There is none here, I think. You may join us, for my part, but there is a strange look about you. You are a dangerous man. What is your name?"
"Nathan the Wronged, I call myself," said Turin, and Nathan he was afterwards called by the outlaws.
But though he told them that he had suffered injustice, and to any who claimed the like he ever lent too ready an ear, no more would he reveal concerning his life or his home. Yet they saw that he had fallen from some high state, and that though he had nothing but his arms, those were made by elven smiths. He soon won their praise, for he was strong and valiant, and had more skill in the woods than they, and they trusted him, for he was not greedy, and took little thought for himself. But they feared him, because of his sudden angers, which they seldom understood. To Dorioth, Turin could not, or in pride, would not, return. To Nargothrond, since the fall of Felagund, none were admitted. To the lesser folk of Holoth, in Brethil, he did not deign to go, and to Dor Lomen he did not dare, for it was closely beset. And one man alone could not hope at that time, as he thought, to come through the passes of the Mountains of Shadow. Therefore Turin abode with the outlaws, since the company of any man made the hardship of the wild more easy to endure. And because he wished to live, and could not be ever at strife with them, he did little to restrain their evil deeds. Yet at times pity and shame would wake in him, and then he was perilous in his anger. In this way he lived to that year's end, and through the need and hunger of winter, until stirring came, and then a fair spring. Now in the woods south of Teiglin, as has been told, there were still some homesteads of men, hardy and wary, though now few in number. Though they loved them not at all, and pitied them little, they would in bitter winter put out such food as they could well spare, where the Gowerwife might find it. And so they hoped to avoid the bandit attack of the famished. But they earned less gratitude so from the outlaws than from beasts and birds, and they were saved rather by their dogs and their fences. For each homestead had great hedges about its cleared land, and about the houses was a ditch and a stockade, and there were paths from stead to stead, and men could summon help and need by horn calls. But when spring was come, it was perilous for the Garrowithe to linger so near to the houses of the woodmen, who might gather and hunt them down. And Turin wondered, therefore, that Forweg did not lead them away. There was more food and game, and less peril away south, where no men remained. Then one day, Turin missed Forweg, and also Andrag, his friend, and he asked where they were, but his companions laughed.
"Away on business of their own, I guess," said Ulrad. "They will be back before long, and then we shall move. In haste, maybe, for we shall be lucky if they do not bring the hive bees after them."
The sun shone, and the young leaves were green, and Turin was irked by the squalid camp of the outlaws, and he wandered away, alone, far into the forest. Against his will he remembered the hidden kingdom, and he seemed to hear the names of the flowers of Dorioth as echoes of an old tongue almost forgotten. But on a sudden he heard cries, and from a hazel thicket a young woman ran out. Her clothes were rent by thorns, and she was in great fear, and stumbling she fell, gasping, to the ground. Then Turin, springing towards the thicket with drawn sword, hewed down a man that burst from the hazels in pursuit. And he saw only in the very stroke that it was Forweg. But as he stood looking down in amaze at the blood upon the grass, Andrag came out and halted, also astounded.
"Evil work, Nathan!" he cried, and drew his sword.
But Turin's mood ran cold, and he said to Andrag,
"Where are the orcs, then? Have you outrun them to help her?"
"Orcs," said Andrag.
"Fool, you call yourself an outlaw. Outlaws know no law but their needs. Look to your own, Nathan, and leave us to mind ours."
"I will do so," said Turin. "But today our paths have crossed.
You will leave the woman to me, or you will join Forweg."